If you go down the list of pieces that orchestras tend to play in our time, you find there are not a lot of pieces composed after 1930. That certainly leaves classical music open to the charge that it's all by dead white guys. And why is that? Why did the canon get stuck? Our guest this hour explores some answers by undertaking a major exploration of classical music in the 20th century and slightly before. John Malcheri is the author of The War on Music, Reclaiming the 20th Century. John Malcheri made his conducting debut in 1966 and has since conducted many major orchestras and supervised the music for operas and Broadway productions. John has often featured the works of refugee composers and works banned by the Nazis. John Malcheri, an honor. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, thank you. It's really good to be with you and to hear the weather. My goodness, lots of weather, huh?
There is lots of weather. We serve a region about the size of Ireland with all the microclimate, so that's why.
And it sounds like a weather report for Ireland.
I appreciate that.
For 7 years, I was music director of Scottish Opera in Glasgow, and whenever the weather report would come out, I would call it the comedy hour because there'd be all these isobars on maps. And by the time the person was finished telling you, basically it came down to it's going to rain. But there were different versions of it's going to rain, like it's going to be bright spells, you know, showers, blustery. It all meant it's going to rain. And, you know, so you go, okay. And then one day every year the sun would come out and all of the Glaswegians would take their shirts off and look like a lobster the next day. So that was my experience with the British weather.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing that. You put a big smile on Maddie's face after having done that forecast.
Hi, Maddie.
Getting into the book, I unintentionally cringed at the second paragraph in the book because you include the term denazification in there, which certainly has some fresh meaning. But this really is a major part of what happened to music in the 20th century, isn't it?
Well, it's, you know, we can start the story in this middle part of it, which is of course World War II. Part of you queued this up or teed this up really perfectly because it's always been odd to me that, you know, let's say theater, plays, art, ballet. There've been lots of masterpieces, lots of films. Goodness knows, I mean, how many masterpieces, you know, they're not all masterpieces, but there are two or three every year, it seems. And so if we look at classical music and what's being played by orchestras since, say, about 1930, 1940, or written, that's sort of the landing zone, right? And you go, why is that? I mean, why was the last Italian opera in the repertory written in 1924? I mean, why does that happen? That shouldn't happen. If it happened everywhere, you'd go, well, there'd be some general reason for that. So the point of all of this, Jeff, is that music of all things, I mean, this is what's so fascinating about it, of all things, music became so important to the governments that went to war, whether that's World War I, World War II, or the Cold War. And you would think that it might be something else, but And specifically, it was mostly classical music. So if, you know, I were in a room full of people and I'd say, who cares about classical music? And I don't know how many hands would raise up, but of course, you know, your listeners, there might be more as an NPR station. But, you know, people might, and you go, well, let me just say this. Hitler certainly cared about classical music, and so did Mussolini. And it might interest you that Stalin really was interested in classical music. And, oh, by the way, so was President Eisenhower. And the CIA director and the Secretary of State. And you go, well, that's weird, right? Like, what is it about music? And specifically, what is it about classical music? And so I decided, as I learned more about it, because this, you know, I say in the beginning of The War on Music, I did not set out to prove a point. In the past 50 years of conducting, and it's 50-plus years, And, you know, I was put on the faculty at Yale when I was 21 years old, and I taught for 15 years. So people thought I was pretty smart or talented or whatever, and I'd been going to concerts since I was a kid. But after that, when I left, or actually during some of the time I was there, I kept tripping over music I'd never heard of, composers no one ever taught me about, names of people. Or I found music that people told me was no good, that I heard inadvertently, and I went, gee, what's that great piece? And then I found out it was written by somebody who I had been told wasn't good. So it made me kind of explore what happened. And mind you, it's a it's a complicated story. I mean, anybody listening to my blathering here this in your morning here, it's my
it's
afternoon,
interesting.
Is that you don't think about that much, but consider just a few kind of facts that we talk about in the book. In World War I, the various countries that went to war saw classical music as part of their power, of their cultural identity. Germans were proud, of course, of their history of inventing the symphony, the string quartet, and Beethoven, and this was Wagner. This was all part of their Schubert. It was just the Austro-German history. The Italians had invented opera. The French invented ballet. It was part of the deal. So even though in the centuries before there were French dances and Italian dances, Baroque dances, but no one looked at that as being a reason why Italy is better, say, than Germany. It was not. It was just a style kind of thing. So for World War I, it was a power thing. It was symbolic or emblematic of the country's vitality. And to give you an example, in 1917, the Metropolitan Opera in New York stopped playing Wagner and Beethoven's one opera, because they believed that the music kind of had in it the Hun, the spirit of the Hun, when we were about to go to war with the Germans. You can imagine Beethoven, of all people, because, Beethoven then in World War II became a symbol of freedom. Mm-hmm. That was victory, V for victory. Beethoven, we still see him as the great, proto-democrat in the world, about people having rights. But in fact, it was used exactly the opposite way. Then in World War II, if we're skipping from World War to World War, it became a target. So especially in Germany, it was not only a certain kind of music, the modern styles that were basically where Schoenberg was the leader of a small group of people, Webern and Baird.
So, John, you were explaining about the fact that the certainly both world wars featured some differences in how the works of certain composers from certain countries, or for that matter, ethnic backgrounds, were used or not.
Yeah, and when you'd asked about denazification, that's going to happen for the Cold War, the period just after World War II. But think about this for a minute. Most people who study music or told about music, let's say that, they're told that 1913 was a really big day time because of the Rite of Spring having its premiere in Paris and the riots at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées. For me, the crucial year is 1933, and that is the year that Hitler comes to power in Berlin. But at the other side of the globe, in Los Angeles, that's the year that Max Steiner writes the score to King Kong. Now, your listeners are going, what? Well, I'll explain that, because when Hitler came to power, he made it impossible for any Jewish musician to be performed. Or to be a performer. So if you played an orchestra, if you taught music, but if you were a composer, you were done. You could not have your music played. And as the Third Reich was getting bigger, it became clear to any Jewish musician that they would have no life anymore as musicians, or maybe at life period. But because Steiner, who was born in Vienna, he was out in L.A. way before the others, proved that you could write music under a dialogue scene. You could use music in a talking picture that would make a fairly unbelievable little puppet, King Kong, feel like, a 50-foot giant, but also give us empathy toward that monster at the end, that every studio wanted to have composers and orchestras to accompany their dramatic films. Now, that meant that where the door was closing in Europe, it was opening in Los Angeles. So the greatest of the young generation of European-trained composers, they were in their 20s, so you had from Budapest, you had Miklós Rozsa, who was studying in Leipzig, and then, would come to America and write Spellbound and write Ben-Hur, right, compose that. Or you have Branislav Koper from Warsaw, and he would write Mutiny on the Bounty and Anti-Mame. Or you have Korngold from Vienna, and he would do The Adventures of Robin Hood, et cetera. Franz Waxman from Germany, and he would do Sunset Boulevard, and he would do A Place in the Sun and write 100 film scores. These geniuses who might have written for films in Europe or might have written operas and symphonies came to America and continued writing their music from Europe in the Hollywood studios. And as they continued writing music, which was heard by hundreds of millions of people, Jeff, Right? The war is still going on, and they are writing music in the other avant-garde, the avant-garde called movies. You see, everyone has talked the avant-garde had to do with non-tonal music, right, and organized 12 tones and various things. But if you were a kid and you could write music that could be affixed to a drama and everything was synchronized and you could perform it, so the composer was also the performer and you could not remove it and you could have your music heard all over the world, well, that's another kind of avant-garde, isn't it? So finally, to get to the last of these wars, the Cold War, then came, of course, what happens after and the denazification of Western Europe. And also what the Germans, how they responded to what they had done. I mean, after all, if you're a country that takes pride in being the country that created classical music, and Kurt Weill and Paul Hindemith and Arnold Schoenberg and Erich Wolfgang Korngold, to name four, survived the war in America and wrote music and were now American citizens, right? The enemy country. So on the one hand, you are proud of your musical heritage. On the other hand, it must be unbearable to listen to any of Hindemith's symphonies written in New Haven, Connecticut. And so something happens where the Europeans, who we all look at as our advisors, you know, they a lot of the music and classical music comes from them and from what they developed. So it became impossible for them to listen to that music. And we're still living in the shadow of that, because we don't hear the music of Paul Hindemith written in America. And these are great symphonies. And we also denigrate Hollywood film music. So the book, The War on Music, is about let's all pull back, let's all listen to the music and see the triumph of continuity in spite of these wars.
John Malcherry, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his book is The War on Music, Reclaiming the 20th Century. You take us back even earlier than the 20th century to Brahms and Wagner in the 19th century, opposites in certainly in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I wonder how many of your listeners see them as opposites now. You know, when you listen to, I tell the story of Brahms' Third Symphony, which I think is a really moving example of it. You know, Brahms wrote everything but operas, and Wagner only wrote operas. So that kind of is easy, you know, for us to look at. I mean, it's true that Wagner did a little of this and that, but mostly we only care about Wagner for his operas. And for Brahms, he never wrote a single opera, right? Although he would, well, obviously he knew operas and he played them all the time at the piano. But you see, Brahms was described as writing pure music. It wasn't about anything. It was just Symphony Number 3, Symphony Number 4. And Wagner was always writing operas with stories and, in fact, was accused of writing, not writing music, but writing scenery, right? Because he could describe fire, he could describe waterfalls, he could describe a rainbow, but was it real music? And this was the argument that we got into the early 20th century. What is pure music, as if there's such a thing, and what is program music, which is considered less good? But I think it's really significant that I tell this story about Brahms was in the middle of writing the Third Symphony when he learned that Wagner had died. And to tell the reader that Brahms owned manuscripts of Wagner's music. In fact, Brahms even copied out orchestral parts to make money for Wagner concerts. So he knew his Wagner. And it's a wonderful story about how inside the Symphony Number 3 are references to Wagner. After Wagner had died, Brahms writes this love letter to Wagner, but in a secret way that only we musicians probably know about. But I thought I would share the secret with the readers, so they could do a little forensic analysis when they hear these moments in the Third Symphony, right from its mysterious ending. You know, it's the only symphony by Brahms that ends quietly, right? And the curtain comes down, and you hear the da 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 da, which is the opening of Das Rheingold reversed. And, you know, so if you start to imagine that in the Andante movement, suddenly it stops and there's this melody that comes from nowhere. What is that? It goes higher and higher. It's so heartbreakingly beautiful. And then the music sort of stops and you go, oh, I know what that tune is. That's the love motif from The Ring of the Nibelungen. Da da da, and you know, du bist der Lenz, and then you hear da 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 da, and it just goes into this Brahmsian, you know, keening, beautiful love moment to the dead master Wagner, and you go, oh, I see, It's not about opposites. It's about continuity. Music is not about one revolution after another. But there's always something new, and there's always something that's the same, and there's something that's removed from it. But mostly, it's continuity. Otherwise, we would start every day by, inventing the wheel. And, it's a kind of silly idea that it has to be totally new. I always laugh about Pierre Boulez talking about everything being new. And, he's sitting behind his desk having his café au lait and, wearing his tie. Pierre, you'll have to start by coming up with an idea for the wheel. And that desk thing, that's not new. And by the way, why 12 in an octave, Pierre? Might do something interesting. 13, I don't know, the baker's dozen. But anyway, it was a game of everything having to be new in order to be justifiable. But what's new? The thing about music is that it's never possible to exactly repeat it. That's part of its beauty. Because even if you play a record twice, you're in a different place. You're the receiving end of the music, right? So we're always, people who are older listening to a piece of music they knew when they were a kid, they're hearing it in a different way, even if it's a recording. And we all know as a performer, since I've conducted, major orchestras and most major opera companies, is that you never can, nor do you desire to replicate exactly what you did yesterday. It's impossible. Something's different. The clarinetist takes a breath here. Somebody coughs. It doesn't matter. Our job is to translate. And if it reaches you, the listener, then we've succeeded. If it doesn't reach you, then, it's the same tree falling in the forest and, no one was there. Did it make a sound? And so that's why the book is a call to play the music. Let us hear all these great pieces, these composers who've been silenced because of the various wars. We have a story here of continuity that takes us from Beethoven and Mahler and Wagner and Strauss right up to today. And most orchestras will play a contemporary piece that just sits on top of Beethoven and Tchaikovsky with no link to why a piece from 2022 is sitting on top of a piece from 1822. Where is 1950 or 1980 or 2000? And where is that continuity? Because that's really communication. That's communion. That's really what I believe music's about.
Now you really have the Reclaiming the 20th Century part of John Mountcherry's book, The War on Music, and you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we explore the different changes in music over the 20th century and the fact that a lot of it got left behind. Join us on the exchange with your phone calls at 800-838-3760. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. Jill in Talent dropped off a comment to say that she worked at the Hollywood Bowl as an usher for her first job while you, John, were a conductor in residence, and wanted to thank you for the elegant music choices that introduced Jill to some of her favorite musicians and composers.
Oh, that's really sweet. Thank you so much. Yeah, I was at the Hollywood Bowl. Well, this is part of, again, when we first started talking, Jeff, I said I didn't start writing this book with a conclusion. I started writing the book because it confused me. In 1991, two things happened in my life that simultaneously. One was I was asked to be a principal conductor on a series of recordings of music that was banned by Hitler, right? And so we were recording in Berlin, and it was for the Decca Record Company and Art der Musik series. And so it meant learning the music of Korngold and Krennic and music that was banned, or whether Schoenberg or as I said, it goes on. Flamen by Schulhoff, for example. I'd never heard of Schulhoff. But at the same time, the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra was created for me in 1991, and I blithely said, and we're going to play music written in Los Angeles. Why did I say that? Well, the Los Angeles Philharmonic never played music written in Los Angeles. I mean, rarely, let's say. That included Stravinsky, who was living there, and Schoenberg, but it also meant all the film composers. And I didn't even know their histories, right? Because there was no biography of Korngold, no biography of Steiner. There's a biography of Max Steiner, 300 film scores, that just came out last year. It's the only one. It's incredibly important. Anyway, so I had this learning curve. Who were the composers in Hollywood? Who were the composers banned by Hitler? And surprisingly enough, names on one list were on the other list. And that's the part of the story that no one told me. That most of those composers were refugee Jews who had studied in the greatest conservatories of Europe and escaped with their lives and wrote the music that is the foundational music of the golden age of movies. Were they writing movie music? No, they were just writing music for the medium of of movies. So now people say, oh, that sounds like movie music. But actually, it also sounds like Strauss and Mahler, because this is the music of its time. And gradually, so-called movie music evolves so that it's influenced by American influences. And so the European-born composers start to add things like jazz and other music to their musical quiver, to their lexicon. And within 10 years, American-born composers who have gone to our greatest conservatories start to write for Hollywood under the guidance and inspiration of the first generation. So we have a sense of continuity here, whereas that doesn't exist in Europe because they actually cut that off. So that's part of what I learned, and that's why I did want to write this book, because it no one knows that. I mean, if you say Miklos Roja, people might know his name, but if you say Spellbound, if you say Ben-Hur, if you say El Cid, it doesn't matter. Go through the list. You go, oh, the man who wrote that music. Well, who was he? And strangely enough, Jeff, certain classical composers, whether that's Aaron Copland or Leonard Bernstein, they got their name plastered in the front of all their scores, right? So you know this is Aaron Copland's music to Appalachian Spring. But the Hollywood composers, who theoretically were in huge show business, never touted themselves, their names. I mean, their names appear, you know, for 1 second at the beginning of a picture. But they were so busy doing other things that they never seemed to care about becoming famous by name. So again, we have to, you know, turn our sights to them and to the people they influenced. And I think that's part of our responsibility, because it's music that brings joy. And one last thing, I don't think that in concertizing and finding repertory, it would be really wonderful if orchestras did not ghettoize film music, but played music written for the film next to music that they would play for the concert hall. Anyway, we do that all the time. You play the overture to Egmont by Beethoven. That was never intended for a concert. That was intended for the beginning of a play by Goethe. Midsummer Night's Dream, that was intended for a play. We play The Rite of Spring or Firebird. That was intended for the ballet. So in many cases, the masterpieces can be transferred to the concert hall, even if they weren't originally intended that way.
That's something I was going to ask you, is whether in fact some of these movie pieces have been played in concert halls, and generally not, you're saying.
Well, that's right. And there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, unless the composer made a concert suite from it, in some cases they did, there'd be no version of it. So part of what I've done in the past, since the Hollywood Bowl days, which that nice person referenced, is I would go to the original manuscripts and sew them back together again, because the way you write film music is slightly different from the way you write other kinds of music, which is to say you decide where the music is and where it isn't. So there are a series of cues. So the cue could be 5 minutes and 47 seconds, and then there's no music for 5 minutes, and then it comes back. For example, in Gone with the Wind, which is a great example of how Max Steiner was using Wagner's principles of leitmotif. So at the beginning of the movie of Gone with the Wind, you hear a fanfare, and you hear da-da-da-da, and when you hear that, you see the words go across the screen. It says, Gone with the Wind. And interestingly enough, the tune fits Gone with the Wind. I mean, it's the same, you know, it actually fits the words. Mm-hmm. Then about 10 minutes into the picture, you hear the theme again when Scarlett O'Hara is told about land and how important it is. And Katie Scarlett O'Hara, you know, it's land that matters and only land. And the camera pulls back and you hear that tune. You don't hear that again for well over an hour. And when it comes back and the Civil War is over and Scarlett O'Hara's mother is dead and her father has gone mad and she says, I'll never be hungry again, that tune comes back and it seals the entire hour and a half first part of Gone with the Wind, because your brain makes that collective moment, right?
So, and that is the intermission point, yes.
That's exactly. And that is exactly how Wagner used the leitmotif to link together the 4 days, the 4 nights of the Ring of the Nibelungen. I mean, he had to figure out how do you tell a story in music that's going to take 15 or 16 hours from the beginning of Das Rheingold to the end of Götterdämmerung? And he came up with this amazing idea of creating these melodies that would be linked to characters and situations. It could be a thing like the ring or a sword, or it could be young Siegfried or Brunhilde. It could be hate. It could be the worth of women. It could be a rainbow. It could be a dragon. And that's what links the entire ring together. So it makes sense that these first composers who went to Hollywood, who studied in the European conservatories, used the same techniques.
There's a portion of the book, we talked about the Brahms and Wagner lead up to the 20th century. You also get into Schoenberg and Stravinsky, and particularly with Stravinsky and the Rite of Spring. And you write about your own feeling conducting Rite of Spring, and not a place you were particularly inclined to go.
Yeah, you know, when the last time I conducted it was in London with the London Symphony. You know, the first time I conducted the Rite of Spring, you know, look, let's face it, everybody has their Rite of Spring moment, who knows the Rite of Spring. If you were an adolescent boy, as I was the first time I heard it, it was kind of right up your alley, right? I mean, all of that toxic masculinity, you know, before I even knew what the story was, I mean, it was just this amazing, thumping, wildly, you know, exciting piece of music. And Stravinsky had recorded it in 1960, so I was 14 years old, and this was a new stereo recording of the composer himself at the Columbia Symphony Orchestra. When I first conducted it with the Yale Symphony, which I was, you know, I conducted, I was music director for 7 years when I was in my early 20s, I found, first of all, I was surprised that it had all these sections with names. You know, the kiss to the earth, the entrance of the sage, the ritual dance. The abduction is a kind of a nice word for rape. I mean, you know, jeu de rapt in French, the game of abduction. And then the chosen one. And I started for the first time to learn its story. You know, what was this thing about? What was it about? Because I just heard notes. And I conducted it, and of course it's a big challenge when you're young and you have to deal with it many meters. And after I had conducted it, and the kids played it so well, I found that I was angry for a week. And, you know, I couldn't figure that out. My wife couldn't figure it out either. And I knew it was good, a standing ovation, you know, that kind of thing. And believe it or not, the Rite of Spring is not as difficult to play as it is maybe to conduct. It doesn't have really hard string parts, which is always a difficulty for a college orchestra. But no, in fact, this was really a great performance. Next time I did it, which is about 3 years later, the same thing happened. And over the years, I'd been conducting the Rite of Spring, and I realized that, you know, in my first book, because the book we're talking about, The War on Music, is my third book. The first one's called Maestros and Their Music, The Art and Alchemy of Conducting, in which I explore what it is to be a conductor. I mean, everybody sees us, but you rarely know what we're doing, and who's worthy of standing up there, put a stick in his or her hand, and why is anybody following us? And do they need us, blah, 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 et cetera. So one of the things that I learned was that in order to do any piece of music, you have to climb into it. Music requires translators. You know, you can love the Sistine Chapel, and you can go to the Vatican and take a tour and, you know, look up at the sky and see this amazing thing, but you can't change it. I mean, you can look at it, but when you're dealing with the equivalent of, let's say, the Sistine Chapel, Mahler's Third Symphony, and you're the conductor, well, you're changing the proportions. You're focusing in on something in the violas. You're taking a little bit more time here. You're speeding up over there. You are actually translating it. You're telling its story. And so sometimes I use the image of climbing into its costume and walking around in it, because it requires that. That's what music requires. It requires a translator, the kindness, not of strangers, but the kindness of people who love it. So this was something that I realized. The reason I was getting so upset was that in order to conduct the Rite of Spring, you have to be it. And when you get to that place where there are 11 hits, I mean, this is the moment where it all becomes horrible. I mean, terrible. You have 11 strikes, and you have two timpanists, you've got the lower strings, you've got the bass drum, and it goes bum, 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 bum. I don't have to do 11. any conductor who gets to this place is counting, right? You're doing, you know, 9, 10, 11. Bum, 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 bum. So your hand is slicing through the air. You are actually committing this crime. You are aggressing in the air. Not only are you the perpetrator, but you're the first person to receive it because the orchestra is right in front of you and each hit is slamming into your chest. And you have to conduct that, not like you're Zeus on the top of Mount Olympus, but you are actually in the trenches. You are stabbing. You are hitting. And then what happens after that is just one damn complicated thing after another. And when it's over, unlike any other ballet before it, there's no epilogue. There's no anything. It's just over. That little girl, that young girl, that virgin, she's 13 years old, maybe she's 14, drops dead. And the very end of it is a specific description of her dropping. It goes, zoom, boom, and blackout. Now, if it were any other kind of composer, any other time, there'd be an epilogue. On the very simplest level, the Rite of Spring was you have this girl dance herself to death to appease the goddess of spring. So the epilogue would have been a tableau in which the trees would blossom, all the things you said at the beginning of this conversation, enjoy spring. It would prove that we were right. You know, there'd be flowers, trees, and everything, and there'd be this great moment, just like the end of Firebird, which has an epilogue. Or there'd be something else, like, oh, we should never treat our teenage girls like this anymore, and there'd be a sad epilogue. But there's nothing. There's just that. It's just violence, and it's led by men, you know, the wise men who choose the girl. And it was so terrible to me that I said, okay, I know I have that in me because I know everybody has this potential in them. But that's not where I ever want to go. I don't want to, I mean, it's fine that I could meet myself, the worst part of me, the violent part of me. But I don't actually need to do this anymore. And there are lots of people who like to do it. But I would say to my colleagues who conduct the Rite of Spring, if you get to the end of it and you smile, then you have no idea what you just conducted, right? Do not smile.
Right, going to a dark place there. So I guess the ultimate question here then that the book revolves around, The War on Music, is whether the not embracing of things into the canon after 1930 was just sort of music moving on, or was it accepting the banning of Hitler and the like, or was it also that, you know, the music had gone into an avant-garde direction and as you mentioned, some of the atonal 12-tone stuff?
Well, I'll tell you, after the war, the denazification of Europe, which you asked about right at the beginning, part of how you proved you weren't a Nazi was that you proved that you composed atonal music because the Nazis had banned it, right? That's one way to get out of jail for free. This was also true in Italy, and it was certainly still banned in the Soviet Union. So the non-tonal music became emblematic of freedom of expression and being against the Axis powers. I mean, it's a naive idea, but it actually was part of what happened. I think also the young men, and they were all men who were growing up in the rubble of World War II, who had no idea, you know, had no, you know, responsibility for having created that war. So you think of Boulez or Zanakis or Stockhausen, who were growing up, especially Stockhausen in Cologne, which had been carpet bombed. Imagine what his life was like. So that when he decided to write music, he couldn't write happy, beautiful, funny music. I mean, Theodor Adorno said that, you know, beauty was unacceptable after the war. He actually said, you know, dissonance is more pleasurable than consonance. So there was that going on. And we in America, we desperately needed to support these young intellectuals of Europe because the Soviets, if you're ready for that, were touting themselves as being the European culture people. I mean, now Putin is describing Russia as being, I guess, the East, because he's fighting the West as if these were places. I mean, they're directions, everybody. East and West are directions. There's no line, right? So if you're in Tokyo, the East is Los Angeles. So, I mean, we say they're the East, but, you know. So the point about this is that the Soviets were saying, no. We're the ones who write operas, and we're the ones who write beautiful, uplifting symphonies, and America has no culture. We then took the official stance to support the avant-garde, which had gone into hiding after World War I, and it became the official language of Western Europe and of freedom of expression. And that also meant that the beautiful music written by those Germans who had escaped the war, that became unbearable to listen to. So a complex, beautiful, uplifting score by Hindemith, who was neither was not Jewish, by the way, nor was he a Nazi. He was, you know, he was a Lutheran. His wife was a Catholic. You couldn't hear that either because it was too unbearable. So they made up fake reasons. I mean, Hindemith was writing the same thing over and over again, so he's boring. Schoenberg in America was unhappy. He didn't write enough music. And by the way, Schoenberg was writing really beautiful non-12-tone music while he was in Los Angeles, and no one in the avant-garde wanted to play that. Korngold was never any good. We thought he was good, but he was never good. He was, you know, and Kurt Weill had sold out to Broadway. So they, with four different aesthetic reasons, said, don't play this music, even though all four of them were the four greatest, most highly touted young composers of Austro-Germany in the 1920s. And somehow, by 1945, they were no good. Which doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, does it, Jeff? I mean, just because a composer moves to another country, you would have a hard time justifying that for any other composer. I mean, Mozart was writing all over Europe, and Wagner wrote The Ring in Switzerland, and he was not allowed in Germany, et cetera. I mean, you just have a list. You know, Wagner died in Venice. And by the way, you know, Rachmaninoff died in Beverly Hills. So we don't tell these stories about how America, by the way, you know, really saved this culture and continued it in our own American way. I don't know how much time we have left, but let me
about just 3 minutes.
Okay, let's take Ukraine for a minute because you brought that up at the beginning. All right. Let's think about who Leonard Bernstein's parents. Where did they come from?
Leonard Ukraine. Bernstein's parents, Ukraine. Okay, yeah.
Where did George Gershwin's parents come from?
Russia.
Ukraine.
Ukraine also.
Hmm? Ukraine. Mm-hmm. All right. So. Elmer Bernstein, Magnificent Seven, where did his parents come from? Ukraine. Bernard Herrmann, Psycho, where did his parents come from? Ukraine. Jerry Goldsmith, go through this list. And so if the anti-Semitism, the official anti-Semitism of that part of the world where they were burning down cities and towns, and, you know, having the pogroms, our country, you know, which does not have a 100, you know, spotless history and list, but we were a place that people could come to and find freedom. Those boys, those young men who were born of Ukrainian parents created, you know, a huge percentage of what we think of. Imagine if George Gershwin had been born in Odessa. Imagine if Leonard Bernstein had been born in Rovno-Guberniya. But no, they were born in this country, and they heard all kinds of other music, and they created the music we call American. So it's a really great story. We need to learn the story of this country and learn the story of the 20th century and have a much better idea of how music is the wide embrace. It's neither East nor West, and the only good music is the music that you love. And don't let anybody tell you that you're just not smart enough to like a certain kind of music. It's an emotional thing, and it always has been that. We invented music as humans. It's a unique invention because it doesn't protect our family. It doesn't feed our kids. It's useless, and yet it's the most wonderful thing because it's useless and invisible, and it travels with us. It says who we are.
So about 1 minute left just to ask the question about, don't we forget periods with regularity, particularly in the pre-recording period, don't we? I mean, the works of J.S. Bach ended up having to be re-unearthed in Mozart's time, didn't they?
Yeah, actually, it was Mendelssohn who really started bringing that back and other musicologists. That's right. It comes and goes. But here we are with a repertory crisis. And we have, you know, now everyone's saying, oh, John Williams, you know, he's great. The Berlin Philharmonic, Vienna Philharmonic. Well, he's always been great. And he's always been that continuity because he played Celesta when, you know, when these first immigrants, geniuses, were composing in Hollywood. This is where we go. This is the endless and unending story of communication.
Indeed. The book is called The War on Music, Reclaiming the 20th Century. It's a comprehensive look and a good read, too, and obviously a great conversation with the author, John Malcherry. John, thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. Have a good day.
You too. It's been a pleasure.